The Gemara tells us that Ba'achris HaYomim, at the end of days, when Mashiach comes, there will be a unique gathering. The entire world will gather, but the gathering that the Gemara describes is not a joyous occasion. It's not celebrations, not dancing in the streets. The Gemara describes it as Safta Aretz Mishpachos Mishpachot. There'll be eulogies, crying, bitter tears throughout the world. And the Gemara says, why would that be? When Mashiach comes, evil ends, mankind is redeemed, and the human race understands life in a fundamentally different manner, and life takes on a whole new meaning. Why are they crying? Explains the Gemara, because it's for the Yetzirah Shenerag, because Hashem kills the Yetzirah. Says the Gemara, that's a reason to say a hesped, that's a reason to cry, that's a reason to dance. Explains the Gemara that actually what happens is, Lasi Lavo, Mevi HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeYetzahara, Hashem brings the Yetzahara, and Hashem shechs him in front of the Tzaddikim and in front of the Rishayim. Hashem literally puts an end to evil, but not just in a euphoric kind of, or euphemistic kind of manner. Hashem literally kills the Satan, ends that power in the world. But Hashem does it in front of the Tzaddikim, in front of the righteous ones, and in front of the Rishayim. And then the Gemara goes on to say, Tzaddikim, to the Tzaddik, say, Yetzirah appears like a Har Gavoa, like a powerful mountain. To the Rishayim, and to the wicked people, he appears like a Chut HaSara, like a hare. Halal Bochim, Valal Bochim, each group cries. Tzaddikim, Bochim, Va'omrim, the Tzaddikim cry because they say, how could we have possibly vanquished this mountain? And they see the Yetzirah as a powerful, powerful force. They see him as a mountain, and they cry, saying the words, how could we have possibly won against this mighty tyrant? And the Rishayim cry. But the Rishayim cry because they see a different image, and they cry because they say the words, how could we have fallen for this Chut HaSa'ara, this hair, this nothing, this weak little thing? Each group cries, and that's how the Gemara explains that moment. And I'd like to ask two rather obvious questions on that Gemara. Question number one is, which one's right? The Tzaddikim see the Yetzirah as a powerful mountain. The Rishayim, the wicked people, see him as a thin hair. Which image is correct? But question number two is far more profound. If we try to imagine something outside of our frame of reference, typically it's difficult. If a blind man would try to envision seeing, it's a very, very great jump for him. And if you can imagine a blind man asking the question, how can you tell whether it's an elephant or a giraffe when it's so distant? How can you tell if it's a building or a car? But more than that, how can you possibly know whether that object is moving closer to you or further away? You can't touch it, you can't sense it. Because to a blind man, vision is not within his frame of reference. And for us, one of the things that's not in our frame of reference is what it's going to be like in the time of Mashiach. But the Rambam is very clear. The Rambam says, Olam kiminhago noheg. The world will continue in the very same manner that it does now. You'll still get a job. You'll still take a seed and plant it in the ground. The world physically will be identical to the world we live in now. The key distinction between now and the time of Mashiach is Mole Haaretz Deyas Hashem. The entire world will be filled with knowledge of Hashem. Every human being will get it. Every human being will know that Hashem is present right here. That Hashem created the world. Hashem maintains physicality. Hashem orchestrates every action on the planet. And Hashem is present. And that single piece of knowledge changes everything. Jealousy disappears. Evil disappears. I won't steal from you because, number one, Hashem runs the world and Hashem gives what each person needs. Number two, Hashem is here watching. But it's so clear and so obvious that every human being understands it. And if you could imagine from darkness, suddenly the sun rises and it rises to its full height with the brilliance of a sun at midday, every human being understands life in a fundamentally different manner. Therefore, I understand why the wicked people cry. They wasted this one opportunity called life. If in that one blazing moment of reality, they recognize that they blew it, they had one chance to grow, to accomplish, and who they are for eternity is what they made themselves into, I understand why the wicked people cry. But why do the tzaddikim, why do the righteous people cry? They should be dancing. I don't care how powerful he is. I don't care how mighty he looks like a mountain. Hashem killed him. You won. Why are they crying? And let's see if we could try to answer these two questions and get a better understanding of what this Gemara is sharing with us. And to do that, let me share with you an interesting observation. One of the biggest mistakes that we human beings make constantly is we think of ourselves as physical beings. Listen, I'm physical. You punch me, ow, you hurt me. You hurt my arm, you hurt me. And we get so accustomed to thinking of ourselves as physical beings that when we, every once in a while, have a spiritual experience, it's almost strange. You know, you'll come to shul on Yom Kippur and you'll feel holiness. Maybe on Shabbos, you'll feel something in the day. You'll really feel like you're speaking to Hashem. And it's strange because here I am, this physical being, temporarily having this spiritual experience. My friends, nothing could be further from the truth. You and I are not physical beings temporarily having spiritual experiences. I, the one who thinks, the one who feels, began under the Kisei HaKavod. Hashem chose a generation. Hashem chose a family into a particular birth order. Hashem put me into this body. But I, the one who thinks, I, the one who feels, am not physical. When I go to sleep at night, my body is still there. In the good old days, how'd you kill the king? The king was a mighty, he was a lout, but he was also a warrior, and he was always armed. When the king went to sleep, you killed him because the king wasn't, what do you mean he wasn't there? His body's there, but he is not there. You see, I am the one inside. I tell my arms to move. I tell my legs to move, but I am not physical. Now, it's a little strange because my entire life I've always been here. I've always woken up every morning and I've been in this body, but it's I inside who feels, who thinks, who remembers, am inside this body. And when you begin to think in these terms in a far more enlightened manner, you begin to come to the first question that should hit a thinking person. And that is, how do you take a neshama, a soul, an I, brilliant and incisive, who understands why I'm here, who recognizes that every action creates an indelible imprint in me. Every mitzvah helps me grow. Every avera damages me. But every conversation, every thought is a part of me forever. So how do you take a brilliant thinking neshama and give it free will? Meaning to say, I would never do something that would be damaging to myself purposely. I wouldn't drink a cup of bleach for $100. I wouldn't do it. If you gave me a jug of Clorox, you could offer me $1,000, $10,000. I'm not going to down it. Why? Because it's foolish. So how do you take the I, brilliant and understanding, and actually give it free will? So to do that, Hashem put us into this body that's not just a physical body. The body has a part to it that's almost physical, but not quite. It's called the nefesh habahami, the animal soul of man. And if you'd like to clearly recognize and define the nefesh of man, the nefesh habahami, just go into the wild kingdom, and you'll find that each species has been programmed with all of the instincts, all of the needs, all of the desires to keep itself alive. The Siberian tiger instinctively hunts the deer. The robin hungers for the worm. The robin doesn't say, based on the general availability as well as the nutritional value, I think I'll use the worm as my food staple. The robin hungers for the worm, but there's a nefesh. There's a part to the robin that's live, that's real. A number of years ago in Rochester, we had a fellow who, when he was a little guy, his father bought him a puppy. And this fellow and the puppy grew up together. This fellow came to yeshiva. And it was very difficult on his dog because the dog missed his master. And every 6 weeks when this fellow would go home, his now grown dog was so overjoyed to see his master that the dog would run over and, excuse my expression, relieve itself on its master's pants legs. The fellow was not quite so happy to see his dog, but here's the point. There's a part to the dog that forms attachments, that forms a sense of identity with and creates a certain bond. Hashem created in every animal in the animal kingdom a nefesh, a live, vibrant part with all of the instincts that it needs to stay alive, as well as bringing the next species into existence. Every animal has a nefesh and has a brain. But make no mistake, the bird can seek 25,000 seeds that it laid in different places the past season, and it can find them. It will hide seeds in multiple mirrored places and find it, because the bird has a brain, the bird has a nefesh, but it's extremely limited. The key distinction between the animal world and us is that I have an I, an anochi, an inner agenda, will. I am a person, but again, it's I, it's not my body, it's me. But to give man free will, Hashem put me into this body that has many drives and instincts. It has a nefesh abahami, and into that nefesh, Hashem placed all of the instincts needed to keep man alive. And these two parts, the neshama and the nefesh abahami, are in constant battle, each vying for primacy, each fighting for domination of the I, and each one vying to control me. However, that alone would not create free will. Why? Because still, I would never do something that's foolish. If you offered me $100 to put my hand in a fire, I wouldn't do it. If you offered me $1,000, I wouldn't do it. Why? Because again, it's a foolish activity. And if I, the neshama, recognize that these acts are good for me and these acts are bad for me, how could I be tempted? How could I be swayed? And to actually create real free will, Hashem put another dimension into man. Hashem created something called the Satan. Gemara tells us that the Satan is a malach, a spiritual force. It's a spiritual force who is given a very particular job. His job is to even the playing fields and to tempt me to do that which isn't wrong. Now, we in Western civilization were very sophisticated, and when you start talking about angels and spiritual forces, we get a little bit uncomfortable. But that doesn't mean we're right about it. And if you'd like to understand life in a much deeper manner, you have to understand that Hashem created different forces in the world. One of those forces is something called a satan, which is a malach. It's an angel who's on the job 24/7, 364 with one job. His job is to get you to fail. His job is to get you to mess up. His job is to get you to sin. However, he's only allowed to function in a very limited manner. If you or I had to face a malach head on, if this malach, this angel, this spiritual force, was given full allowance to operate at his full power, we'd be putty, we'd be history. But Hashem keeps him in check, and it's always in accordance to who you are. So imagine for a moment that I'm this sort of balanced, half nefesh abahami, half nefesh sichli, my neshama, balanced against the animal instincts within me. And imagine that 50-50, and the satan is allowed to operate in a very limited fashion. He's allowed a little bit of power. What happens if I grow? What happens if I do what's right, what's good, what's proper? What happens if I listen to my neshama? The nefesh abahami, the animal soul, becomes weaker, has less sway over me. The neshama comes more to the fore. I become no longer 50-50, but now 60-40. The satan, that angel, is allowed to function at a greater level. And if I get to 70-30, he's allowed more control. And if I get to 80-20, he's allowed even more. Would you like to understand this Gemara? Do you know why the Tzaddikim see this angel as a powerful mountain? Because they spent their lives perfecting themselves. They spent their lives working on themselves. And they spent their entire existence perfecting themselves to the extent that they got to 80-20, 90-10, 95-5, and therefore the Satan, that spiritual force, was allowed full control. And to them, it appears like a mountain because that was the power that it was allowed to exhibit. You know, the Gemara says, Mishet Gadol Mechaver, one who's greater than his friend, Yitzro, his Yetzer is greater than his friend. It does not mean his physical desires. It doesn't mean his appetites. Quite the opposite. If a person grows and accomplishes, he becomes the master of himself. But if he becomes the master of himself, and he completely masters his drives and desires, and he gets to the point where his neshama comes to the fore, and he clearly sees the value of every action and the impact, then there's no free will left. Why? Because he sees things with too great a clarity. And to allow for free will, even in that stage, Hashem allows the Satan more control. And when Hashem ends the Satan's reign, when Mashiach comes to the Tzaddikim, he appears like this powerful mountain, Har Gavoa. Why? Because that's the amount he was allowed to exhibit himself and function in their world. Why is it that to the wicked people, he's like a Chut Asara, a hair? Because that's all they needed. For them to trip up, for them to fail, they were 50-50, maybe 60-40 the other way. And Sutton wasn't allowed much control. Why? Because they were anyway halfway down the pike, and he was only allowed to function in that limited way. And I believe this Gemara is a fundamental concept to us, and I'll explain to you why. My father was born in Berlin. In 1938, he escaped, and he spent the war years in England. And I remember one time my father was telling me that they would read the papers, as any Jew certainly in those years did, with bated breath. And one day he read about the fact that the Allies were bombing the heavy water plants in Germany. And my father said they had the question, what in the world are you wasting good bombs to bomb a heavy water plant, whatever that is? And for the life of him, he couldn't understand why they would waste ammunition. In 1945, in August of that year, the world understood when two modern industrial cities were demolished, blocks and blocks, entire neighborhoods, an entire city was leveled, humankind recognized that atomic power is a force that's well out of the previous understanding of mankind. One of the ingredients to create an atom bomb then was uranium. You needed heavy water to distill parts of it. But it wasn't until a little bit later that the average man in the street understood it. We live in a very sophisticated world. We live in a world where we understand that this solid object is actually electrons spinning, moving in constant motion, that most of physical objects are actually emptiness, and that if you were to magnify this and look at it on an atomic level, what you'd see is mostly vast emptiness with electrons spinning around, and everything that's really in existence is the bonds that are formed between electrons. Most of matter is empty. Now, we don't view the world that way, but we're aware of it. When you put your popcorn in the microwave and ding, 3 minutes later it comes out popped, you're aware that modern science knows things that you and I don't. When they level cities, when they put nuclear submarines for 6 months in the ocean, you recognize that harnessing a force that my eye cannot see is something that actually works. What we understand is that much of what we recognize in the physical world is but the tip of the iceberg. We're very comfortable pulling out a cell phone, sending a signal to a satellite some 3 miles in the sky, which sends it to another satellite, which sends it to a relay station, and we talk to our friends, our neighbors, 6,000 miles away as if they're around the corner. We don't see the microwaves, we don't see the transmissions, but we're very comfortable with knowing that there are things that my eye doesn't see but are still real. And if you're not sure that I'm correct, anyone here ever see electricity? Right? What color is electricity? Anyone know? Well, it's no color because electricity is a theory. You cannot see electricity. When you see the lightning bolt, you're seeing the electrons burn off some impurity in the air, but electricity is not visible to human sight. Now, it's a pretty good theory, because if you try to put a key in a socket, you'll see that it's a very, very solid theory. But the point is, I don't see it. I don't see the wires running through my house. I don't see the electricity running through it. But I plug in my vacuum cleaner, and it works. I get it. And as we are very comfortable with being aware of matter, energy, properties that exist that my eye doesn't see, one of the things that we have to also be aware of that there are whole other dimensions that we're also not clued into. And one of those dimensions is the spiritual entities of this world. Everything that Hashem created, zeh l'uma zeh, every physical property has a spiritual dimension to it. But not only does it have a spiritual dimension, the spiritual dimension is larger, the spiritual dimension is more powerful, and the spiritual dimension is what keeps the physical part in existence. And one of the things that Hashem created in this world is something called the Satan, that is a malach who is on the job 24/7 with the sole job description of getting you and I to fail. Oh, come on, Rabbi, you want me to believe in angels? Angels? So it depends if you want to be sophisticated or you want to be a nar. If you don't want to be too enlightened, you could look at this physical thing and say it's a solid piece of wood and I don't believe in the atomic theory. But if you'd like to understand life on a deeper level and you open a sefer and see the way Chazal describe it, you see a very different world. One of the things, and probably the primary way that the Satan works in our world, is by speaking in your brain. And I want to clue you into something that most people are not aware of. Open the Chovos HaLevavos, Shar Yichud HaMaisa, Perek He, page after page after page of what the Satan will say inside your brain. He speaks in your voice. He speaks with your inflections, with your sort of nuances, but explains the Chovos HaLevavos, he isn't you. It's a foreign entity speaking in your voice, speaking in your head. And if you ever heard someone say, I'm hearing voices in my head, you got it. You got it exactly. Come on, Rabbi. I have voices? Yes, exactly. And if you're not sure that I'm right, let me sort of describe a little bit how he functions. And let's see if this resonates or not. The Satan is the greatest salesman who ever lived. You will never, ever see a salesman like him. And if you'd like to learn sales technique, study him. Technique number one. Wow, this is the greatest, the most unbelievable thing. In the world. You got to have it. I mean, wow. I mean, nothing in the world compares to this. Whoa, this is unbelievable. And he'll build it up and build it up. And week after week, it's great. It's unbelievable. It's great. But you know that it's usur. It's forbidden. And he'll say to you, come on, look at you. And you suffer so much. And you have such a rough life. And no one takes care of you. Come on. You deserve a little pleasure in this world. Come on, it's not so bad. And you'll say inside your head, I'm not doing that. That's forbidden. It's usur. I'm not doing it. And this is when the Satan gets to work. Come on, it's not so forbidden. It's not a clear isur. It's not so bad. It's not so bad. Week after week after week, he'll take a major avera, something that you recognize clearly as wrong, and he'll make it littler and littler and littler and teeny and tiny and teeny and tiny until finally you do it. And then, oh my goodness, do you know what you did? You just did the largest sin in the world. You know what you did? You just did the most egregious act ever. I can't believe it. You're the most dirty slime and I can't even... You ever notice that? For weeks and weeks, there's a voice in your head saying, come on, it's not so bad, it's not so bad. Come on, other people do worse. Other people do plenty worse. Until you do whatever that is, and then, boom, it becomes the biggest, most large entity. Chofetz Chaim explains it. He says, you know, a telescope? You take a telescope, and it takes an object that's very distant, and by focusing the light, you're able to see very clearly the details, the lunar craters, and able to see the texture. But if you take a telescope and turn it around and look in the wrong end, it takes an object that's already distant and makes it even smaller, explains the Chofetz Chaim, that's exactly one of the main tricks of the Satan. Weeks and weeks, months and months, he takes an object, makes it smaller and smaller and smaller until you do it, and then, wow, he blows it up. And he's a Bucky and Shas and Poskim, and he'll quote for you things you never even remembered that you learned in third grade. And he'll quote for you Gemaras, he'll quote for you Rishonim, how bad and how evil you are. Pay attention sometimes to what goes on in your brain. Pay attention sometimes to your thought process, and you'll quickly see that we human beings are far more complex than modern psychology realizes. Because modern psychology has some ideas of some of the elements, but there's a whole dimension that they're clueless to. And if you would like to see one of the strangest phenomena in human existence, and just pay careful attention to the voices in your brain, pay careful attention to what you say to yourself, and what you'll quickly see is that much of it is not generated by you. And am I allowed to have a little fun? It's Erev Yom Kippur. All right, we'll skip it for now, but okay. Let's explain why the tzaddikim cry. And do you know why the tzaddikim cry when the satan is shechted? Do you know why? And Rashi explains very simply. Because at that moment, they look back on their life. At that moment, Mashiach is here, and like a blazing sun at midday, every human being sees clearly why we're here. And every human being recognizes life from a different vantage point. The tzaddikim look back on their life and see, oh my goodness, he was here and here, bothering me and bothering me, creating trouble, creating problems. What am I talking about? Here. Okay. Let me enjoy myself for a minute. You'll humor me. You have a ninth grader, young yeshiva bachur, in a way at a yeshiva out of town, and he's walking down a street, and he passes a treif pizza shop. Now, what happens? All of a sudden, there's a strange voice in his head that says, hey, why don't you, take a whiff? Smells pretty good, huh? Yeah. Hey, you're real hungry, aren't you? Yeah. And that smells probably better than anything you ever smelled in your life, huh?
Yeah, it really does.
Why don't we go across the street, kind of just a little closer,
Okay.
Hey, where are we going, guys? What are we doing? Hey, come on, yeshiva guy, where are we going? And our fearless hero finds himself across the street, a little closer to the pizza shop, and the voice in his head says something like, hey, come on, why don't you just take a deep, deep, deep whiff? That smells great, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It smells better than anything you've ever smelt in your life, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I bet you're so hungry, aren't you?
Yeah.
Hey guys, what's going on here? Come on, what's happening? What's going on? Hey, don't listen to him. Let's go in. Let's go. Let's for the fun of it. Let's go and buy a slice. We're not gonna eat or anything. Let's just buy.
Okay.
Hey, where are we going? We're going to.
You heard the man. We're only just gonna go into the pizza shop, okay?
Hey, what are we doing, guys? What are we doing? All right, anyway, our fearless hero buys 6 pies, eats them, has his stomach pumped next day. What am I describing? Within you, there are 3 parts, and we human beings are clueless. There is a Nefesh Abahami, which is a powerful group of desires, appetites, and hungers. There is a Seichel that's brilliant in understanding, and is a third voice that speaks in my head. And if you begin studying yourself, you begin to understand life a little differently. If you begin studying what really happens, you begin realizing that things aren't quite as simple as you once thought. Let me give you a couple of examples. Maybe it'll help. A number of years ago, when I first began, I was in yeshiva. I'm a pretty reasonably competitive person, and there was a fellow who was in my shir, who was much smarter than me, and he was a tremendous masmid. He was a powerful guy, and I sort of used him as my target. Whenever he would leave the base medrash, I would stay till he left, and however early in the morning he would come, we sort of competed one with the other. It was a friendly competition, but I found it very helpful. However, here was the problem. He was smarter than me, better than me in learning, and he always left the Beis Medrash after me and was there before me in the morning. And he really was a very solid guy in learning. Okay. Anyway, after that summer, I came back to yeshiva, and I found that he wasn't there. I said, ask around what happened. Somebody said, oh, he went to work. I was very surprised. This young guy, maybe 19, and I didn't understand why he stopped learning. You know, want to get an education, you can do that at night. What? I didn't get it. Okay. A number of years later, I met him at a wedding, and I said, you know, we started talking, how are you doing? Good. You know, and I said to him, I'm a little curious. You know, I remember we used to learn together, we used to be very friendly, and all of a sudden you were gone. What happened? He said, you know, I'll tell you what happened. I'm not cut out for learning. Not for me. I don't have the head for it. I don't have the situation. I don't have the energy. Not for me. And I found it a little funny because I was still in yeshiva. This guy was better than me. This guy was smarter than me. And this guy was more involved in learning. So I said, so who is cut out for learning? He said, a guy like you, pointing to me. And I said to myself, oh my goodness, I get it. He threw away his entire future because he fell for one of the greatest tricks. My friends, if you pay attention to the lines that we sell ourselves and the damage that we do to ourselves on a regular basis, I'm telling you, it's frightening. As a high school Rebbe, I used to see this all the time. It didn't happen quite this way, but almost this way. Monday night and Wednesday night. Monday night, I'd get a guy who was very, very successful. Very good at learning, very good at secular studies, great basketball player, very popular guy, all milers. And he'd come to me and say, Rebbe, I want to talk to you. I said, that one's doing. I don't feel good about myself. I feel like I'm unaccomplished. I just feel like a loser. So I try to talk to him and try to straighten out his thinking. Wednesday night, a guy comes in. The guy is not particularly good in learning, not particularly good in secular studies, not a good ball player, not very popular, about an average as you get. Rebbe, you want to talk to me? What's up? I can't help a feeling but that I'm just better than everyone else. I don't want to feel that way, but I just feel I'm superior. Can you help me? And I said to myself, oh my goodness, can we just switch brains? Take Monday night guy's brain and put in a Wednesday night guy, and Wednesday, and we'd be perfect. But if you pay attention to the damage that most people do to themselves with thoughts, what you'll quickly see is that there's some strange things going on in the human. And some of these things are obvious and some aren't. Let me give you some obvious ones. What about a guy who every time he davens Shemoneh Esrei, when he gets to the word Hashem, excuse me, saying it in a shul, the word Jesus pops into his brain? Now, the psychologist explained to him that it's something called obsessive compulsive disorder, but it doesn't make him feel any better. But that's an extreme case. What if I tell you that very good people, very solid people, on a regular basis destroy their future because they believe either that they're worthless or they can't succeed, or there's a voice inside that bothers them and bothers them until they do things that are so destructive to themselves. Want to hear another example that the ladies may not appreciate so much? I've seen very frum women, who know why they're here, understand life, and they go out dressed perfectly, sleeves all the way down, skirt all the way down, except one problem. The clothing that they wear looks like it's painted on them, like someone took a spray can and that's sneeze. Come on, it's modest. Don't come. Come on. But how could you do that? How could you do that when you're embarrassing yourself, the dignity and the honor? The answer is because this is what's done. I can't look like I don't know how to dress. I can't be not like, you know, acceptable. And people do things. And my friends, what I'm sharing with you is that the forces that make a person do many of the things that we do are not just regular thoughts, but there's a satan, there's a powerful malach who's on the job 24/7, speaking in your brain and making you do things that you normally wouldn't, that you certainly don't want to do. Now, if you want to get really sophisticated, you could listen for him, but even if you don't, just analyze your own thinking. And I'll explain to you what I mean. Here's a question I want to ask you. In a few days, it's going to be Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, we have a specific mitzvah called Inui, certainly not to eat, not to drink. Now, isn't that strange? Yom Kippur is a day of Slicha Mechila. Yom Kippur is a day a person can get close to Hashem. Yom Kippur is a day we're going to spend the whole day in shul davening. Wouldn't you assume that it would be wise to eat a good breakfast? Come into shul with energy. You got a whole day of davening ahead. You have so much to think about, so much to discuss, so much to work on in your own life. Obviously, you need a good nutritional breakfast. And yet the Torah says to fast. Why is that? So the Chofetz Chaim explains why it is. He says, don't you understand? There are different parts to I. There's a part of me that's an neshama, that's brilliant, that's incisive, that understands why I'm here. And there's a nefesh bahami, and that's all of the animal drives in the human, and those two parts are competing. And the more you feed either one, the stronger it becomes. And you ever notice what happens about 2 o'clock, Yom Kippur day? There's a different sort of clarity. There's a different sort of understanding. It's not just the day. There's a difference in you. And granted, you're not as strong. And granted, you're not as maybe vibrant and alert. But there's a different perception that you have. And why is that? Because your body has less sway. The other part of you has less control, and you're more lucid. You're able to see things more clearly because the part of you, your neshama, has come out more to the fore. And I'd like to share with you that there are two main things that a Jew should be doing on Yom Kippur. One, obviously, is reviewing your actions, your conversations, and what you said to who, and that's called doing tshuva, and that's called going through the whole process of tshuva. But there's something else that a person should be doing on Yom Kippur. And that is a major look at your life. You should be spending time on Yom Kippur asking yourself, am I happy with me? Am I satisfied with the way I'm living my life? Certainly it's a very good time to look at relationships. You ever notice that couples come to the marriage therapist, to the Rav, and everyone is pointing a finger at the other? I have never once had a couple come in and say, you know, we both agree that it's his fault. No, we both agree it's her fault. No, we're in agreement it's our fault. Please help us. That's not what I say. His fault, her fault. And it's always the other one's fault. And it's always my spouse. The problem is my spouse. Now I have a question. It can't always be mine. Why is that? Because we human beings are very, very good at remembering the pain that others cause us, but we're not so skilled at remembering what we did to agitate them to bring it on. Would you like a very good Musar exercise on Yom Kippur? Think about every troubled relationship you have, but now with a different vantage point, with new eyes. When the body becomes weaker and you're able to be somewhat self-introspective, somewhat honest, ask yourself, okay, what was my share of the guilt? My share? No, stop it. Stop it. What was my part in the equation? And if you pay careful attention and you really analyze, what you'll find is that many of the lines that we sell ourselves aren't true. Yom Kippur is a unique day. It's a day when a Jew can reach different understanding, different feelings. And by the way, it's a day when the Satan is not on the job. It's only 364, but the Satan is not allowed to bother you on Yom Kippur. And what that means is you have a clear head. It's you, and your body's getting weaker, and you can look at your days, look at your life, ask yourself, am I happy with me? And if not, what's my game plan? What am I going to change? What am I going to work on? What am I going to do differently this year than I did before? And it's a day that you can feel things that you wouldn't feel the rest of the year. It's a day when you could do introspection and thinking that you normally wouldn't reach. And it's also a good day to ask yourself, do I really understand things well? You see, the ultimate solution to the Satan is something called truth. And by the way, it's a very wise idea to ask Eitzah, to ask others, whether it be friends, whether it be older people, preferably someone older and wiser, Because invariably we are caught up in ourselves, invariably we're nogea, and it's very hard to see through things. I think this Gemara is sharing with us a powerful perspective. The Rishayim see the Satan killed, and the Tzaddikim see him killed, and each cry. The Rishayim, the wicked people, cry because they say to themselves, I blew it. I blew eternity for nothing. I gave it up for a hair. He was nothing. But the reason why the Tzaddikim cry is because at that moment, there's a sudden hush. You ever notice you're on an LL flight, and after 13 hours, the plane lands, and they shut the jets off, and there's a deafening silence. And only when they shut off the jets do you realize how noisy they were till then. The reason why the Tzaddikim cry is not because he's monstrous, not because he was so powerful, but because they look back on their lives and they say, oh my goodness, he was here and here, that day and that day, in my brain, talking and bothering me, talking and bothering me. You ever hear the expression, demons in your head? And my friends, it is a major, major issue. And you have to daven, you have to ask Hashem for help, you have to watch your thinking. And I want to share one thought. And that is that if you don't control your thoughts, you are toast. You see, your thinking shapes your moods. Your thinking shapes your feelings. Your thinking shapes your reality. And if you don't control your thoughts, something else does. Either your appetites, drives, desires, nefesh habami, or the satan, whatever it may be. But you can control your thinking. And that sometimes means doing very real exercises. That means if a person has a negative self-esteem and they're constantly beating themselves up, it means controlling it and learning to say the words, no, I'm in charge, I'm not thinking those thoughts, I'm thinking the thoughts I want. And if a person begins taking control of their thinking, they begin taking control of their life, and they begin a different track in life. Everyone has it. Everyone deals with it. And I think this Gemara shares with us the extent of how much a part of us it is. And I want to close with one last thought. And that is the Mashal disagrees with one thing that Rashi says. Rashi says the Tzaddikim cry because in that moment they see how powerful the Satan was, how involved in their lives he was, and that's why they cry. Mashal says, I agree. It's vastly different than they saw when they were alive. And it's vastly different than they saw before Mashiach came. But that doesn't make sense why they would cry. Because now they're at the point when everyone gets it. They're at that moment of the finish line. Even if they see the pain, even if they see what they suffered, they now should be dancing a jig. They should be happy as a lark. Why would they cry? Would you like to know what the Mashiach says? Explain it to you with a mushroom. A number of years ago, I was a high school rebbe, and I pulled a muscle on my back. There was a dentist in town who used to do powerlifting. He said to me, listen, I'll take you to the gym, and there's a coach there. Art will make you as good as anything. So I went with this fellow down to the gym, and I met Art. Art was the widest human being I've ever met. Art would bench press 400 pounds like it was nothing. And Art was a very interesting fellow and a very dedicated coach. He worked with me and for a good while, and it was very effective, and it helped my problem. And after a while, there was a fellow in the kollel who was a bit yeshivish, who said to me, you know, I know you go to the gym regularly, would you take me? And I looked at this guy and I said to myself, oh my goodness. I mean, when I was a kid, I played ball, I lifted weights. It wasn't, you know, when I went to the gym, it was something I was familiar with. This was a type of fellow who probably doesn't know which end to hold the basketball on, hasn't worked out in his life. I said, sure, let's go. So I took him down. I guess when he walked in with the sweatpants and the black shoes, Art recognized pretty quickly that we're not dealing with a world-class athlete. But this fellow, Art, was a very dedicated coach, and he worked with him very closely. And this yeshivish fellow started learning how to lift weights. He started learning how to deadlift, how to squat, started bench pressing. And after 6 weeks, this fellow says to me, you know something, that guy, Art, the coach, I don't know what's wrong with him. Every time I get the motion right, he puts more weight on the bar. What's wrong with the guy? I said to myself, Nartabist, Progressive weight training is about increasing the load on the body. When you increase the load, the body is forced to respond. It's not about the motion, it's about putting more weight so you can force the body to grow. Moshe says that's pshat. Do you understand what the righteous people, what the tzaddikim see? At that moment, they recognize how much bigger, how much greater they are because of that force in the world called the Yetzirah, called the Satan. At that moment, they recognize that every time he was there bothering them, every time he was there giving them trouble, he forced them to reach in deep within themselves, and forced them to grow, forced them to become a different person. And the person that they are now, those great people, they are because of him. Having a personal coach on the job 24/7, 364. And if you find yourself thinking things, being bothered by things, recognize where they come from, recognize what they're about, try to gain control of your thinking. And again, Yom Kippur is specifically a day very much slated for that. May the Kadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom and the ability to put it into practice. May this be a very good, meaningful Yom Kippur. Again, I just want to mention that on the way out, if you want, we have the marriage seminar, the free CDs, and the marriage seminar in general. And I want to again thank the sponsors. A good adventure. Yeah, there will be a mic. There will be a marav right now in the shul.